The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
So we are here in the great city of New Orleans. I got Shemek Lubecki. We are in the offices of Brad Eggenberg from the Eggenberg Trial Lawyers. We finished a little trial workshop. So we had, who do we have down here?
Well, we had a bunch of people from HKM. It's a national employment firm from Denver. We're working on a case that I'm trying.
Right.
In a few weeks.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. That was a good time for the last few days, getting some reps in, working, brainstorming these cases. But that's what's brought us together here. But now, Shemek and I have been going back maybe, 5 years? Well, you came to the first TLU 2021.
I did.
That's
yeah.
Right. Did you watch our stuff during the pandemic?
You know what? I think I watched one or two case analyses.
Really?
But then one of your Facebook ads popped up for TLU 2021. And I was working a police shooting case at the time. And I used that sort of as an excuse to go to absorb all the other stuff that was on the offering.
Yeah. How'd you like TLU 2021?
I mean, for me, it was transformational because whereas before, when I was in Chicago, I was at a trial firm trying a lot of cases. As a plaintiff's lawyer, even though I was trying cases occasionally, I was in a sort of different milieu in a firm that did not have a culture built around trying cases. And it was nice, just from a mindset perspective, to be around people that were getting after it, that were rural trial lawyers, and were trying, you know, plaintiff's cases at a level that, quite honestly, I had not been exposed to before.
Yes, it's amazing. When you say milieu, did you really mean say mill?
That's a good one. Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Anyways. And so you came out 2021, and that was actually, I'm down here with the Southern Trial Lawyers, and which starts tomorrow. But when I was down here a few years ago at the Southern Trial Lawyers, we connected there, and then you eventually came to a boot camp.
That's right.
And it was a long time ago. It was a little bit different boot camp than it is now with the trucking case. That was the great tanning salon case that anybody's ever done
it,
a boot camp will. We'll always remember the story of Anthony Dubé. So Shemek, but before we go into this part of the story, tell us how is it that what inspired you to become a lawyer?
You know what? I don't know if it was any one particular thing. When I went to undergrad, I thought I was going to be a doctor. And that obviously didn't pan out in terms of, you know, whatever, biochemistry or whatever the hell they expect you to take. But I think I always, to some degree, always enjoyed conflict in a weird way. And I thought that trial lawyering was about that, at least to some degree. And I thought that it was the next logical step for me.
But where were you when this idea came into your head? Were you in college?
I was in college.
All right, but give us a little bit of your backstory, though, because it's a little different, because you weren't born here. So.
Right. So I was born in Poland. We emigrated from Poland as political refugees, went to Germany, lived there for a year and a half, learned, you know, I went to German schools, I learned German. And then in 89, we finally got asylum in the States. So we came to the United States. Settled in St. Louis. Why? I'm not really sure why St. Louis. I think it was like our charity sponsor was in St. Louis or something like that. And so I went to middle school and high school there. And then I went to Tulane for undergrad in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Left to go to Chicago for law school. And then I started practicing in Chicago.
So where do you go to law school?
Loyola, Chicago.
And did you do any mock trial, moot court, anything like that in law school?
I did, yeah. I mean, there's not a lot about law school necessarily that I enjoyed, but I enjoyed
really
mock trial.
Yeah. There was nothing about law school I enjoyed.
Yeah.
Except getting out of it.
Yep.
That was the most enjoyable part. So you get out of law school, and let me just ask you, where's your first job out?
So when I was in law school, Illinois has a thing called like the 7-11 license or something like that, where you practice under the tutelage of a lawyer. And I worked at the DA's office for a year, got to watch some criminal trials. Those guys were, you know, kind of in the trenches every day in the same courtroom, same judge. And then they had a hiring freeze because I thought I wanted to work in the DA's office to get some trial experience. But luckily enough, because of the hiring freeze, I applied to Perillo Weiss O'Halloran, which at that point was like the most prolific firm as far as trial in Chicago, kind of by a feature of the clients that they represented. But every year for last like 20 something years, they always had the most trials out of any firm in the entire state. And so I knew that when I got a job there that I was going to be thrown in almost right away and get to try cases, which is what I wanted to do.
So how many years do you spend at this defense?
Seven and a half years.
And how many trials do you get under your belt? Seven.
It was over 100. I mean, it was maybe like 110, 120, something like that, I would imagine. I mean, I've had, you know, it's as far as keeping count, I've got some jury verdict reporters. Whenever I would win a case, I would always report my verdict. Whenever I would lose a case, I would generally not report it.
So it's kind of selective, huh?
Well, as far as keeping a tally.
Keeping score.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you don't want a record of your losses. You want a record of your wins, man.
I mean, why have a record?
I've had like 16 or 17 mistrials. So, I mean, just for scale, I've had a lot of
misconduct in the courtroom.
Not always on my motion, but every once in a while it happened.
Uh-huh.
And I was young and brash.
Yes. And now you're older and brash.
Older and wiser. Older and wiser.
Older and wiser. So you're there for seven and a half years. So how do you think those 100+ trials prepared you, you know, to join, you know, next job's plaintiff's firm, right?
Right.
So how do you think that 100+ trials in 7 years, you know, prepared you for the plaintiff's world?
Well, I mean, it prepared me as far as I became a trial lawyer and I was trying cases day in, day out. I do think that defending cases is incredibly easy compared to being a plaintiff's lawyer.
It's like prosecuting a case for the government. It's like, what happened next? The same as a prosecutor, a guy pulled a gun on me. And it's like, it's a real tough fucking job.
Right. And well, and to this day, though, when I look at sometimes the way that defendants are defending my cases, I think they're just doing too much. And I think a straight up burden of proof sort of pathway for the defense is oftentimes a better avenue than whatever it is that they do by hiring experts and spinning up this whole yarn about that doesn't add up. But in terms of preparing me to try a plaintiff's case, I mean, it exposed me, it stress inoculated me, it gave me, you know, a certain measure of
confidence
for sure. Having seen lots of different looks before, having picked a lot of juries, that really, I think, was the number one thing that I took away, is that having picked a ton of juries, it translated immediately into the plaintiff side. What I did not have is the framework and the structure and the framing for a plaintiff's case, which is levels above where any defense firm or defense lawyer is at, quite honestly.
So you're seven years in, 100 trials, and you believe you're a trial lawyer, but you join a firm here in New Orleans that's not a trial firm.
Correct.
So if you're a trial lawyer, can you help us all understand why you would, you know, join a firm that's clearly not a trial firm, where you basically had to pull teeth to get a trial and then have you undercut the whole way?
Well, so the idea at that point was that it's the biggest advertising firm in the state and that there would be a lot of trials to be had. That was logical to me. culturally, it was just a little bit different. You know, I mean, I think the firm's business model is different than a firm that tries cases and tries to maximize the outcome for any individual client. And so because of that, there was always some chafing of ideology as far as what ought to happen on any one case. And it's also easy to get comfortable being in that world of going from one case to the next, to the next, to the next, being financially successful and not having to try cases.
Yeah.
Although I still, you know, I try to, you know, one, two cases a year. But it was not obviously at the rate that I was able to try cases as a defendant, nor would I expect that for any plaintiff's lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that I am capable of trying probably 10 to 12 cases a year as a plaintiff's lawyer without diminishing my ability to actually do a great job on any case.
How long did you spend at this firm?
13 years.
13 years, man. Because the last three I've been telling you guys fucking quit, but finally listened to me.
I did.
Thank God.
Yeah, I will say, I'll give you a lot of credit going back to the mindset shift. One, TLU, which obviously I credit you with the whole TLU, but also just talking to you and going out to Vegas and doing the boot camps and teaching, it does expand your mind in the sense of like, man, other people are doing this. They're getting verdicts. I'm in the same ballpark as they are as far as skill set, right? And so I can do it too.
That's not what you said to yourself. You said, I'm better than all of them.
Well,
I should be able to crush it. I know that's what you said, but humility. That's how humility. I felt when I went to Vegas for Cala. Nick Riley invited me out there like back in 2012. And I saw all these lawyers. I just looked around. I saw the sunshine, the mountains, and big verdicts. And I was a criminal defense man. I'm like, these guys can do it. I can fucking do it better than all of them.
Right, right.
And so I didn't realize it's a little more complicated, you know, becoming a civil lawyer from being a criminal defense lawyer for 17 years. It would take a better man than I did to do that, to do all that grinding work. So I had to find something else to do here.
And thank God you did.
Thank God. Well, thank God for the pandemic. Or,
right.
You know, it would still be called Trojan Horseman. We never, you know, evolved. So your first boot camp is when?
I think early 2022 is when you invited me, I think.
Really? It's been 4 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So.
Yeah, because I think what happened is I came to TLU 2021. And then March of 2022, I had that trucking case. And I called you because I knew that you were the only person that I knew that could connect me with people who knew.
Punitive damages.
I was struggling writing out my punitive damages of 1 year. And then also there was an FMCSA issue that had not really been explored in the case, but I thought would be potentially a death knell for the entirety of the punitive case. And so I called you and you put me in touch with Joe Freed and with Jay Vaughn and with their help and their office's help. I was pretty quickly able to kind of frame the case up and get a great verdict.
What was the verdict in that case?
$12.5 million.
Was your first eight-figure verdict?
It was.
About fucking time, dude.
Right.
I haven't had my own yet, but so I'm moving back to California.
That's right.
In 12 days? No. Yeah, 12 days. Housewarming party.
Oh.
The day I move in. I want to get it started off right.
Oh, make sure I get the invite, although I may be on trial in that Colorado case at that point. Or
you'll be ready for trial.
I'll be getting ready for trial, right?
You'll be ready for trial. So when you first come to the boot camp, we're doing the Anthony Bay case.
Yep.
But what were your takeaways from, you know, the training boot camps?
Oh, so, I mean, it was obviously apparent to me right away what a game changer that was. The message and the secret is always in the reps. And that training focused so tightly on the connection between the lawyer and the jury and micro drilled it. And I mean, we had a conversation about it right after that boot camp, I thought, where it translates directly to everything that I had ever learned from sports, that skill lives in the unconscious mind. As you're developing those skills, you grow that self-image, the confidence sphere also, and that at the moment of performance, strategy and thinking about, you know, the minutiae and details of your case is completely needs not even happen. That work needs to have already been put in, but you're not going to get skill in the few weeks that you're preparing for trial. Those things have to be developed over a long period of time so that it's just there. It's in you. You don't have to think about it. You're the trial lawyer. You're the message. You're the meaning. Facts, the case, it's fungible. Issues.
Interchangeable. Doesn't matter what it is.
Right.
Just give it to me. I can tell it.
Correct.
I can tell the story.
Right.
Yes. Yes. So the things that we work, the things, the skills of, you know, try to like, I'm always trying to figure out how to teach everything better. But eye contact. And so, you know, it's to me, it's always, you see all these, you know, people, you know, lawyers on CBN and stuff. You see them like, look, I mean, just like most people's general, because when people, it just almost drives me nuts in a way. It's when people are like, oh, just, you know, you just gotta be yourself. I'm just like, that's why they're like, I don't really like to train because I don't want to like, that's not who I'm, like myself is. What would you say to somebody who says that? Because like one of the, what somebody earlier was like, was talking about how when they were a public defender, they would, you know, didn't prepare really at all. And it was better that way. And some people really prepared a lot. She felt like they over-prepared. And so she's more like, I just want to be like flowing. And when I hear this, I was like, imagine what I said.
So for, from where I sit, I see a tiny ounce of truth in what she's saying, only in the sense that if you don't care, you're going to be able to perform up to whatever the level of your training is. But if you have a case that you care about, whether it's the dollar amount, whether it's the
life of the client,
life of a client,
innocent person go to prison for 20 years,
right?
If that bothers you at all,
then that pressure is going to amplify whatever internal thoughts you're having. And if you're unprepared, it's going to crush you and it's going to result in a really terrible performance and it's going to be obvious to everybody. And so unless you can somehow convince yourself not to care about a case that you've got hundreds of thousands of dollars invested into or the life of a client or the future of a client, if you can somehow make yourself not care, that's an incredible skill. But if you can't do that, you better be so prepared and have developed so much confidence that that pressure is going to be amplifying your preparation and amplifying your confidence so that you can be the lawyer that you are as opposed to some smaller version of it that's going to shrink in front of the jury and let the other side affect you.
TLU Huntington Beach is going to be the greatest event of 2026. There's going to be 4 lecture tracks, 8 workshop tracks with the top trial lawyers in the country. On Tuesday, June 2nd, there's going to be a golf outing and also a pickleball outing. That night, we're going to have a dinner at the La Rea. We're going to buy it out so everybody gets a chance to meet each other beforehand. And then during the conference, of course, we do a full breakfast, full lunch, and theme parties every night. This year, we're going to be utilizing the pool area and the restaurant for more of the parties. And we're going to have an adult swim right one night, a Satch Oliver party on Friday night. And the last theme party is going to be a 80s Run DMC Adidas jumpsuit. It's going to be the greatest. And last year, we had over 800 people. This year, it's going to be over 1,000. So if you want to be part of it all and you want to stay at the Paseo Hotel, don't delay because it sells out fast and then you're going to be in the overflow. Can't wait to see you there. TLU Beach.
How about controlling of your emotional state? And what's the expression on your face? What's your face telling your audience?
Right. So humans are very good generally about detecting other people's emotional states and just, I mean, that's what juries do, right? I mean, they can read through the bullshit.
So we all do every day.
Right. And so if a lawyer is tense and their face is communicating something unintentionally, well, guess what? It might be affecting your case. It's certainly going to be affecting the connection between you and the jury, because how often do we see a speaker who is nervous? And we are almost nervous for them. We get uncomfortable because they're uncomfortable.
Well, because emotions are contagious.
Right.
We have mirror neurons, just like when somebody has a, you know, warm face when they're looking at us, or when we say, you know, good morning, everyone, instead of good morning, everyone, because we're all nervous, so we have the serious face. But, but when you see a friend, it's like, hey, what's going on?
Yep.
You know, good morning, and your face lights up. And but when you're nervous, it doesn't. And that's why, like Clark, when I started training with him, you know, he's like, you know, he says to me, you have any idea? You know, this is because I showed him my presumption of innocence.
That's right, yeah.
He's like, does that shit work for you? I'm like, I lost 2 cases on the last 100. He's like, any idea why it works? I'm like, no. He goes, when you can make the unconscious conscious, you're gonna be fucking dangerous. In the civil world, call that rich. And of course, I'm like, I want to be rich. And so I'll never forget that. But it's really about making the unconscious conscious, because like we, you know, if our face is warm, we see a friend, or we say good morning to somebody, or we say thank you to somebody, then it lights up like that. If we can consciously go from a neutral face to, you know, looking at the jurors in the eyes, like microwaving it, slowly getting a warm face in the same way we would, like we see a friend,
right.
Well, that's a real skill, and just being in control, intentional with this here. So we ask a question, you know, have an inquisitive face. Like just mindful and controlness is like such a very rare. Does anybody consider that?
I do think that. I mean, are some people better people, and they're better at connecting? Sure. But for any lawyer to say that this does not need to be trained or developed or even thought about, it would be the same as telling, well, you know, Michael Jordan was just born that way, you know, and it's obviously not true. He'll be the first person to tell you about all the work that he put in so that he never has to think about the angle of his wrist when he's making a layup or whatever. And so, like I said before, the messages and the reps, and I think your training, well, even though it has evolved, has been really instrumental in helping me put my brain on that aspect of it. Like, I thought I was decent at it just from being maybe stress inoculated from having tried a lot of cases, but there's levels to it, and I don't think that I was operating at a level where I optimally could be. And so that's been the biggest difference maker for me, and that's why I'm a big fan.
So at one point, when did you start running a local training group here in New Orleans?
You know what? It was probably after the third boot camp. I think you had told me the best way to get good at something is to start teaching it.
No doubt about it. How do you think teaching has helped you in your performance in the courtroom?
Well, it keeps it front of mind, certainly, because if I didn't have my group that meets, you know, not religiously, but we try to meet on Fridays. And for a long time, we were very, very consistent about meeting on Fridays. And it just makes the work easy because it becomes habitual, as opposed to having to schedule it and to toil away. It just happens every Friday at 3:30. We get together and we train. So just exposure to it without having to think about it. It doesn't feel like work. I'm hanging out with my friends. We train. We do oftentimes derail into some strategy or some framing discussion or whatever cases
people
have, because it's natural, but that's also part of the community building and the process. And I think everybody's better for it. I'm better for it. The people that come, the students are better for it. I mean, they're my friends, students. I mean, I don't know how you describe it, but it's an easy, non-transactional, just hangout session where we all get better.
I know. That's why I'm very excited about Hermosa Beach. And
man, it's going to be something.
People coming over all the time and practicing, working on their cases, training.
Yep.
Going to be, and getting to the courtroom, it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's already been a lot of people from the boot camps that have gone on to hit some really nice verdicts.
No doubt about it. But I'm just saying, like, you know, for, like myself getting all that more practice, mm-hmm. and, you know, like Giorgio and King, like teaching, you know, workshops when, you know, I'm not even there. When I am there, I just sit back and it's like, right. You teach it.
Right.
You know, I got my reps, you get yours.
Right.
You know, that's going to be.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful house.
Yes, I'm stoked about that. So we just did a little witness prep mm-hmm. workshop. I got one coming up. I'm pretty stoked about that. But how have you applied the skills of you've learned in witness prep to your trials?
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you know, witness prep is something that is an afterthought for most lawyers. They just think that they can just get a witness to come in and we talk about the case. You feed them some lines. They regurgitate their story. And that so long as you have cued them onto the pitfalls in their case and learn how to steer around them a little bit or ameliorate them, that's the job of the lawyer to get the witness prepped for testimony. And nothing could be further from the truth. getting the witness to be able to imagine and put themselves, transport themselves, is everything. Because again, going back to the human connection part, whether you're in a deposition or you're in a trial, if you're just regurgitating words, it carries no payload, it carries no meaning. Whereas if you're able to transport the listener and make them really feel the story as they would if you're living it when you're telling it, that carries the meaning. And so that report from the defense lawyer is going to look a lot different than if you're just a parrot repeating lines as opposed to living it. And all the more so for trial, when the witness is properly prepped, their stress level is also diminished when they're absorbed in whatever they're talking about. They can imagine it. And it hits different. The information hits the jury. I don't know. I can't describe it scientifically, but it hits them emotionally as opposed to just the logical part of their brain.
So as far as the witness prep goes, since this is the first live podcast in a long time, I'm going to explain it to the jury so they can see it. So like when we prep witnesses, or when I prep witnesses, I sit sort of like this right across from them. And, you know, if there's anybody else there, I thought to know, make sure that they don't react any way to anything the witness does, because that would disrupt the witness.
Right.
You know, if people start laughing at their story or making whatever grunts, you know, the person like starts thinking, oh, I need to adjust my story in some way.
Right. I need to play it up to the
audience. Play it up to them. And so you got to teach them to focus. But so when I prep a witness, first thing I say to them is, viewer of the witness, Shemek, my job is to help you become the best witness that you can be. Okay. And so now we set the intention. So I want this person to know why we're going to do this hard work of reliving it. Because the challenge for us is that people have been traumatized. And, you know, from our financial perspective, the more traumatized, the better, is that they repress it. They bury it. We all do. We all bury pain, loss, hurt. So we can be happy again for the people that we love, for our family, for our children. And that's what they do. And they repress it. Then 2 years later, it's time for deposition. The lawyer's like, oh, I need you to feel it again. And they're like, no, fuck you. I'm not going back there because I don't want to go back in depression. And that's why it's our job to give them the confidence to go back there. And the only way to give them the confidence to go back there is if we basically hold their hand and go back there with them to re-experience the loss and the trauma. But the challenge for us is that really to do that, we have to really go into the loss and pain with them. And have to experience it with them and empathize so deeply with them. Otherwise, they won't go. If they're here and like, you know, just devastated, and you're like, okay, then what happened next?
Right.
They're gonna be like, you don't give a fuck about my story. Unconsciously gonna think this, and they're gonna just stop connecting with their story, and they're just gonna be like, oh, I walked out, I lost my leg. As a matter of factly, because of your emotional demeanor, which is why if we train ourselves to picture what they're saying, well, if we have the image in our mind, then it's going to affect us like it affects them. And so our job is to get them to trust us, to go into those dark places. A kind of metaphor, like for a metaphor, it's like a room. So we can go into this dark room. We can talk about what happened. We can even relive what happened. But then when we're done, we can come back out, shut that door, and come back and be happy and not be devastated. And so they have to trust and believe that, or they won't go.
Right. Well, that trust is everything. And so if you as a lawyer are incapable of demonstrating yourself that you're actually connected to them, then it's never going to happen.
Yes. And so, and from there, I tell them, you know, do this. And I pretend I have like a brain fart. And I'm like, you ever somebody tell a story before and they're like all excited? And you're kind of like, huh? They go, I guess you had to be there. And of course they say yes. And I said, well, what that person was saying is they weren't able to communicate the excitement or the emotion of the event. Whereas we all know people, as soon as they start telling a story, facial expressions change, the facial expressions of the people of the story. Their hands start moving, perfect time with the action of the story. Sometimes their voices even change to imitate or mimic the voice of the people of the story.
Right.
And they tend to disappear for 2 or 3 minutes. When they come back, they're exhausted. And sometimes we're exhausted too, because they went there and we went there with them. You know, people tell stories like that, Shemek?
Of course.
Well, That's how we're going to help you tell a story about of what happened to you and how it affected your life. Because if the jury was there at the scene when you got hit, and if they were there in the hospital as you struggled to stay alive, and they were there at your home with you when you couldn't sleep at night, and when you were so groggy from the medicine, you couldn't have a conversation with your wife, and you were you just didn't want to risk, it was just too much pain to go to the amusement park with your kids, so you stay at home by yourself. If they were aware with you and experienced all that, and you're with you, is there any doubt in your mind that they would find for you, properly compensate you?
No doubt at all.
Well, it's our job to make them witnesses. And so that's what we're going to do. So teaching side note is we all tell stories like that, right? Right. When we're telling them from our unconscious mind.
Right. We're not thinking about it.
Right. We're not trying to tell somebody stories. Like, we're just like, shit, I'm going to fuck with what happened to me. This guy comes in. He's like, I'm like, fuck. And so, but we all do it. And once you start training, you start to see these patterns
right. All
the time. When you see them, then you understand. Then it's like further training. That's kind of when you start to see there's an expression, trained mind sees patterns. The untrained mind only sees randomness.
Yep.
And so as you train, you see it all. And then as you see it, you're still training, right? Because now if you're watching somebody's facial expression, you're watching their hand movement, which I call like whenever there's actions or a verb in any story, people's hands move and they look off and they create space.
Right. I will say that the first step for people who realize that they're kind of getting it is that they become way better observers of themselves. That's probably in terms of breakthroughs for students, that's probably like the first breakthrough is where they're able to kind of stop themselves and self-correct. And that only happens when you've become a better observer of yourself, because in turn, you've become a better observer of everybody else and everybody else's interactions.
After I go through that part there, I do this room exercise, because mm-hmm. I need them to understand about creating space. And so I tell them I want to take a good look around the room, and then I'll do the same thing, right? Because you always got to be modeling for your clients. If you stare at them, you're like, take a good look around the room, they'll be like, and think they have to keep looking at you, right? And then I tell them I want them to close their eyes and show us where everything's at in the room. And so like this picture right here is to my right, it's to your left. And if, the camera's to my left, but it's to your right. Mm-hmm. And there's a TV that's in front of me, but behind you. Because I would do the same thing. There's a picture over here, and a camera over there, and a table right here, and a TV back there, and a set of windows over there, and rays right there. Well, everything would be opposite for you, right?
Right.
And then what I do is I tell them, look, this picture's to my right, but it's to your left. This camera's to my left, but it's to your right. And neither the picture or the camera have changed places. You and I have a different perspective on this room. And every story has a perspective. So we need the story from your perspective. Because the time somebody's deposition has come, they're a couple years into their case typically, and they know so much more about their case than just what they experienced.
Right.
And I'm always worried that that stuff will come, weave itself in, and then it could be a big credibility hit. So I have them do that. And then from there, I tell them, Shemek, doing this process is sort of like we're making a movie. And you're going to be the star of the movie. I'm going to be the director. And the star must listen to the director. Because there's only one person that can star in a director on a movie. And who's that person?
Clint Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood for The Unforgiven. And you're not Clint Eastwood, and I'm not Clint Eastwood. So you're going to be the star. I'm going to be the director. Okay?
Fine.
All right. And it's also like, you ever see that show Star Trek?
I have.
You know that guy Scotty? How he pushes a button and a person will disappear in one place and reappear in another place in time. He transports them.
Well, you just created that space for me. So how could I not?
It's all little bubbles.
Right?
I know.
Right.
Very good at it. But he transports them, right?
Right.
So that's what we can teach you how to transport yourself back in time and space to relive story. Oh, and I meant to use my camera too when I did the room exercise. Then I always take a picture of the room with mm-hmm. my pano mm-hmm. and I'll show it to the witness and say, this is a picture of the room, right? Like, yeah, this picture is flat. This room is three dimensional. It has width, it has length, it has height, it has volume. Well, but the picture is flat. So we have to take this flat picture and stretch it into a three-dimensional image and then step into that image. Because as I tell them, most people look at memories of their life as these flat pictures. Mm-hmm. It's like there's like a metaphor there too to follow. Then after the Star Trek analogy with Scotty, that's so then let's say it was a story of it, you always start with a happy story. Mm-hmm. And you know, the one I like the most is, you know, somebody teaching their son or daughter how to ride a bike.
Yeah.
Because it's universal. Everybody's learned to ride a bike, and many people are parents and they taught their children to ride
right.
a bike.
Right.
And it has that moment.
I remember when my dad taught me how to ride a bike, and I remember when I taught
See
my
that?
Kids how to ride a bike. Yeah, like
See
it was
that?
Yesterday.
It was that moment. Yep. And so that's why it's like a great story. A story that's like graduating from high school is not a good story because there's no highlight moment. Because
right.
the whole idea is to get them to a moment.
Let go when they're on their own.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, no, but right. But also get them to know what it's like to be there.
Right.
And also, there has to be a story that took place before the event that caused the injury.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that happens after the injury is clouded by the
right.
injury. So, plus, could most likely be a good before and after story eventually. So, let's say it was a ride on the bike. So, I'd say, Shemek, you know, which one of your children are we talking about for learning strategic riding?
Let's say Zosha, my oldest.
So, how many years ago is this?
She just turned 10, so this was probably 5 years ago, something like that.
Okay,
maybe 4 years ago.
So she's about 5 years old.
5 or 6, give or take, yeah.
5 or 6. And what time of year is this?
Summertime.
What time of day?
Evening. Beautiful sunset out on Lake Pontchartrain, about a mile from our house.
You say, but what's the weather like overall?
Sunny, mild, like sublime temperatures, like 80 degrees. Not a cloud in the sky. Sun's going down. Orange sunset.
Who else is there besides you and your
daughter? Just me and her.
What color is her bicycle?
Pink.
And what color is the seat on the bicycle?
Pink. You know, no, it's like light brown. Light brownish seat. I have to imagine it to be able to tell you, actually. Yeah.
Well, right. And so why I ask all these questions are, one, I want to focus your mind
yeah.
back then. And two, and so where specifically are we at?
So we're on a running slash bicycle path right on the lakefront that goes from the New Orleans side all the way through Metairie down to Kenner. So it's a long, long, long path. But I always go running out there. We always used to take the kids out on the stroller when they were young out there. We walk out there kind of for exercise, to hang out, to talk.
Be sure to join us in Winter Park, Colorado, March 14th through 21st. We're going to be doing a ski and trial skills boot camp. So we'll be skiing every day, but in the morning and in the evenings, we'll be working on your trial skills. That means witness prep and direct examination, cross-examination, presentation skills, which are opening statement and closing argument, and of course, jury selection. And remember that your entire tuition will be donated to the fight against Uber in California, because they're trying to destroy our civil justice system. And they're starting with California, but if they win here, your state may be next. So join the fight and come to Winter Park.
And so now I've got enough information that I can direct the story. I can mm-hmm. visualize the story, which is critical.
Mm-hmm.
And I've caused you to focus your mind on back then, right?
Sure,
so you're
yeah.
starting to transport.
Yeah.
And so now I have the tools I can begin the story. And so then I have the witness close her eyes and take 5 deep breaths. I try to get my breathing in sync with theirs. I'm trying to get in rapport with them. And then I tell them, you don't have to close your eyes here, Shem. We're not really doing this here. This is a demonstration. Ray, this is just a demonstration. You're supposed to be paying attention, Ray. We're doing this for you too. Ray sometimes gets distracted, but that's okay. Anyways,
focusing.
I would close your eyes, take 5 deep breaths, and I try to get my breathing in sync with them. And then I tell them, Shemek, everything we've experienced in our lives is stored in our minds in pictures and images. So when you tell a story, first see the picture or image. And when you can see the image, step into the image. Imagine that you're there.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that you're no longer here, but you're back there. And none of us are here either, but they're all back, but we're all back there with you, about 10 feet behind you, but you can't see us. And I'm not here. I'm just a voice guiding you. So when you can see the sea, when you're back there, out there on the path, and you can you know, you can see the lake, and you can see your daughter and feel her presence, and you know, feel the warm air on your skin, and you're really back there. Then you can begin your story. Take mm-hmm. your time.
Yeah.
And so the whole idea is to get the transport. And so I'm constantly paying close attention to them. And I'm asking my oneself one question. Are they there? So I'm imagining I'm telling the same story. You know, and so with like things like whenever there's a verb, so things I look for is are they in the past tense?
Right.
If they're in the past tense, probably not there. If there's a verb and there's no movement, if they're like, you know, my daughter's riding her bike and I'm walking behind her, and they're not like, you know, my daughter's riding her bike and I'm kind of walking behind her, then that's another sign. If they talk about, if their emotion is not congruent with the story, if he's like telling he's with his daughter and his face isn't lit up and it's just a 5-year-old and this is a big day of her life, I'm not buying it.
Right.
Because clearly if your daughter's right there and you're back there, they're gonna be like, you know, right. And so, yeah. Or when people use words of emotion, like she was nervous. Well, if you're telling the story right, we can all feel that she was nervous, mm-hmm. right? And the only time we ever explain, you know, talk about our emotions or explain them is when we're not feeling them. So it doesn't help. That's why the worst question ever was is, how did it make you feel?
Yeah.
That's right. That's why it's the crappiest question of all time. I saw somebody doing a presentation on direct. They're like, the best question you can ever ask is, how did it make you feel? Like, I was like, oh my God, this is not good.
Yeah.
I didn't interrupt though. I was polite. So, anyways, and so I'm kind of imagining the story. And so sometimes people transport great, but most don't because they block, even the happy story. Because I videotape them too. I forgot to mention that I videotape. I tell them, look, I'm going to videotape the first two stories so I can play it back and show you when you're transporting and when you're just remembering. And of course, you know, you're gonna have your eyes closed during it, and you know, obviously, I can testify in the courtroom with your eyes closed. But this is just why we're practicing. Just the first two stories. I call it training wheels for the mind, so nothing out there will distract you. All right, so it's just for our purpose. So everybody's always good with that. But the truth is, you only have to do it one time, because after you do it one time, with your eyes closed, I show them. Then I'm asking them questions about, you know, the event that we're there for, right. And they're like, transport almost instantly every time.
Right.
So these are the things I'm looking for. And then if they're not transported, then I'll tell them to freeze time. And it's wherever they're at. I'll tell them to look around from the left to the right and show us what they see so that we can see it too. Just like they showed us this room. Yeah. And I'll be looking and following them. And if their hands, if they're like, you know, over here is the lake and, you know, the trees and my daughter's here and, you know, I'm, you know, and, she, you know, and you know, she's on her bike, because then I'm looking at that to see, I'm trying to imagine it. And then whenever there's dialogue, somebody's talking, or even if there's like, you know, the story that we worked on with Abby was her engagement, and her dog Lou was out there running around, mm-hmm. right? And so when we talk about an animal, especially like a dog, it's like when they get, it's like our face will take the dog's face, right? But I mean, obviously with humans, when we talk about other people telling us, you know, like when you, you know, gave your daughter's part of the story, you'd be like, and then she's like, Dad, we would see right. your daughter's
yeah, tone
face.
Tone of voice changes, face changes, everything, right?
Exactly. But if it doesn't, or they're like, yeah, then I, you know, then my daughter calls out for me. Well, that's a summary of the dialogue with no emotion. Right. So then I'll say, Shamik, you're doing great. No matter what they're doing, they're always doing great because they have to believe in themselves. They have to be confident. I say, Shamik, you're doing great. But whenever there's talking or there's speaking, there's dialogue, you have to hear that person's voice in your head, and that's the voice you must use. However they said it then, you must say it now. You must imagine that you are them. And when you can become that person, and, you know, I said, we can see their face in your face and hear their voice in your voice, then you can tell us what they say. And the exact words are not important as long as you're congruent with your memories. So that is the whole witness prep. Videotape it, play it back, coach them. And then we transition it to a direct, because obviously you can't have a stream of consciousness.
Right.
And so we transition this to direct. You know, I teach them a methodology, and I tell them, look, Shemek, I'm going to teach you a methodology on how to do this. And you follow my 4-step methodology, you will be impenetrable to cross-examination. Most folks are scared of that. Right. So like, okay. So step number one, whenever you ask a question, you make sure you understand the question. If you don't, ask for clarification. Okay?
Yeah.
Then ask yourself, what image must I access in order to answer the question? Then, while accessing the image, answer the question. You're done. Close the image up. Come back to me. I'll know you're ready for the next question.
Yep.
All right? Like I said, to do that, if you do this, you'd be impenetrable to cross-examination. So if I was to say, Shemek, my shirt is orange. Isn't that true? What would you say?
I would say no.
It's orange, right? Just look at it.
It's dark gray.
Right. Notice your demeanor. You're not being defensive. You're talking to me like I'm confused. You know, I'm colorblind, or I don't understand the meanings of the words gray versus orange. Either way, I'm not a bad guy. A defense lawyer, he's not a bad guy either. He's just confused, and we're going to unconfuse him, okay?
Right.
And so most people are like, yeah, let's unconfuse him.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think that's actually that shift is huge, because most witnesses get extremely angry, defensive. They already are going into the position with like we're going to battle kind of mentality, needlessly often. And I think that reframe of unconfused, it lowers the temperature in the room by a lot, and it helps them be congruent and testify and regard the defense attorney kindly, which if that video is, you know, if that deposition is being videoed and it's going to get played at some point, so much better.
Yeah. No, the worst is a defensive witness on the stand. But right. When it happens, I'm like, oh my God.
Right. Man.
Oh,
right. Yeah.
I hate when lawyers are like, oh yeah, my client fucked it up, man. I think it was go great. I'm like, if your client fucked it up, then it's your fault.
Yeah, you ultimately have to take responsibility. Same as
ultimately, when you have to always.
Yeah.
You don't take responsibility. How will you ever get better?
Right.
And you know, if you didn't prepare your client to testify because they fell apart, you didn't prepare your client to testify.
Right.
How is that possibly the client's fault?
Yep.
You know, it drives me crazy. And that's why.
Same thing can be said for lawyers who always blame juries.
Oh, or the judge, or anything else.
After trial. I mean, ultimately, it is your job as a trial lawyer to figure out how the stuff lands with the jury and adjust, right?
March 6th and 7th, witness prep and direct workshop in Hermosa Beach. Pretty stoked about that. I think it'll be the first workshop that we do there.
Nice.
I'm excited.
Nice. Yeah.
I'm so excited.
That's awesome.
A couple, Emmy Lou is coming from that was here.
That's great.
So Shemek, besides the performance skills, though, there's some other aspects to this, because you got some mentoring by a guy named Dave Clark.
I did.
Who is also my mentor, taught me about the unconscious mind. So tell us, what did you glean from your time with Mr. Clark?
Well, so what I learned from Clark is probably the most significant stuff that I've learned as a trial lawyer.
I won't take that personally.
I know. But I learned it through you.
Well, then I will take
Clark, and so I will be appreciative of it always. No, I mean, I think Clark provides the verbal framework for the exact same stuff that you teach in terms of connection. It's the same thing. Transporting somebody, putting them in a trance, putting the jury in a trance. You're doing it with your vocal tone, your timbre of your voice, with your micro connection, with your creation of space, with congruent gestures, with creation of space, with all the things that we teach or that you teach. Clark,
you teach now too.
Well,
so
it's Clark provides the verbal judo to the physical judo that you're teaching. That's kind of the best way I can describe it. Mm. You know, whether we call it neurolinguistic programming, whether we call it reframing, whether we call it putting your audience in a trance, he is able to do stuff verbally that I had never been exposed to and had never thought about.
How about Eric Oliver? Because we were just at the Eric Oliver.
Yeah.
What'd you get from Eric?
Well, the funny thing about Eric Oliver is that a lot of it is same. There's some different disagreements, I think, that Eric Oliver would have with Clark in terms of the reframes. I appreciate both of their perspectives. The great thing about Eric Oliver is that he teaches a method to the way that you look at a case, analyze a case, and present it as a three-part story, and you keep that same structure throughout the case with every witness. It's very methodical, but the underpinning of it resides in the same underpinnings that your stuff resides in and that Clark stuff resides in a sense that we are the meaning. The words are just data. And Eric Oliver teaches that, Clark teaches that, and you teach the same thing.
We are the meaning. The words are just data, same word.
Well, so when you, let's say, are presenting and your creation, your truck is driving down the road, or somebody walks into the Tropicana up to the front counter, or when you're first meeting the jury and you're saying, good morning, everybody, after you connect in the eyes appropriately without being weird, and you're able to hold a glance if you need to and deliver a piece of content to a juror, you are demonstrating so much more than just the words. I mean, good morning, is that really a significant communication? Not really, but you're triggering.
Crazy? Very significant.
Well, it's significant in the sense that it establishes a connection between you and the juror, right? But as far as good morning is, for most people, a meaningless phrase that they utter 10,000 times in a year. But the meaning that you're conveying with your presence, with your ability to stay connected in their eyes, with your warm face, with your face being congruent, like you would be meeting a long-lost friend in the airport, it impacts them and it lands different than if you were just deadpan and just saying the words. The data is the same. You are the vehicle no. to their meaning and to their emotional understanding of the situation. Similar with Clark and similar with Eric Oliver, in that the structure of how you present is going to affect people's understanding of it. The tone of your voice, whether you mirror them or you don't mirror them, a lot of those things are very similar between what David Clark teaches and between what Eric Oliver teaches.
So we got TLU Huntington Beach coming up, which we all know is the greatest conference there ever was. But what will you be teaching at TLU Huntington Beach?
I've got a couple trials coming up where I'm dropping in to try cases for other firms, but one in Colorado, one in California. I've got a couple that are going to be going to trial in Louisiana. And so depending on how those cases go or don't go, I'll probably teach something related to those cases. I'd like to talk about maybe the process of getting ready for trial, because I've learned a ton, both from my own experiences of trying a lot of cases, but also from some of these great people that I've been learning about and I've been exposed to through TLU, is that I do think that I have a better method now for getting up to speed on a case. Because whereas before, you get a case file and you're overwhelmed and you're like, where do I begin? How do I go about this process of trying to figure out how I'm going to present this case? I do think that having a method to it, whether I glean it from Clark, glean it from Eric Oliver, and then having what I call set pieces for these various parts of your case. So going back to confidence being a big part of your performance, if you know that you don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time for voir dire, that's boosting your confidence, because it's like, hey, I have a mental Rolodex of voir dires that have worked for me before. I can change them a little bit. And if I, let's say, need to come up with a whole nother voir dire for this issue in the case or for this reason that I lose, because that's something that you got to think about, right? There's a process to iterating that and to figuring out what voir dire is going to work, because you've done it before in other cases. And so same as with opening. If I have a general structure for how I like to do my openings, I don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. I can take the facts, learn the case, structure a story, and once I arc out the entire opening, I know what my case is about, I know what the defenses are about, and I know how to defeat them. And then all that's left to do is making sure that the evidence comes in the way that I want it to come in, so that I am never forced at the end of the case to talk out of both sides of my mouth on closing. So I'm consistent, my credibility as a lawyer remains intact, and the case that I present at the end is the case that I told him I was going to present at the beginning.
Join us March 6th and 7th in Hermosa Beach, California, for our witness prep and direct examination workshop. You will learn how to transport your plaintiff and before and after witnesses back in time so they not only remember the story, but they relive it so that the jury not only hears it, but they experience it. Because a jury can't provide money for pain they don't feel. This program is limited to 10 participants, so register today.
If you could go back to your graduation from law school, you had, you had a career now. So what advice would you give?
20 years, yeah.
I know, I have a little bit longer than you. What advice would you give that young fellow, though? Was all, thinking he's going to get a job at the prosecutor's office till he frizzled it. But words of wisdom do you give that kid?
I think first and foremost, I would say find a good mentor, because mentorship is hard to come by. It's invaluable. And I think the way to pick your mentor is to figure out who has the skill set that you want to acquire. And I would not regard any financial incentive or how much you're going to get paid in that first job as being at all important, because I mean, I made almost no money when I was a defense lawyer in Chicago, but I gathered a ton of experience from the people that I was working with, and all the people that I was learning from were in the trenches trying cases. And so there was a lot to learn, and just the culture of the place that you work has such a big effect on your image of yourself as a trial lawyer. If you work with people who are operating from a place of insecurity, it's not a healthy environment, and they're going to destroy your image of yourself as a trial lawyer. It's just like wrestling or fighting for a shitty coach. It's not going to be good. Whereas if you're working for people who are good people who have a high level of skill, you're going to be able to advance to where they're at and beyond, so long as you put in the work. And so that would be probably my biggest takeaway, is I don't think I would do much different. I might switch to the plaintiff side sooner, get exposed to, Don Keenan and TLU and Reptile and, all the other strategies that I've learned over the years sooner. But I think working with good people who have the skill set and can mentor you. Pretty invaluable.
But for those people that don't, what do we have?
Well, we have TLU, man. We have TLU on demand. Yeah, it's the most underrated, biggest no-brainer in the history of Earth way to improve.
How do you use it to improve?
Well, so every time I have a case, I look at like-kind cases. I look at various case analyses on them, various presentations on those cases. If there's anything that I'm pretty good at, is being able to take a skill that somebody else has used, or a frame that somebody else has used, and I immediately incorporate it. I steal it shamelessly and I incorporate it into my own case. So I had a, negligent security case in New Orleans. I stole Rahul's entire case, essentially, and put it into my case. If I have a premises liability case, I'll watch a few of those just as a to get ideas, to steal a line for closing. I watch a lot of Rex Parris stuff. I really like the way that he closes. So I've stolen a bunch of stuff.
You have an employment case coming up so with Shelby in Durango. So what are you doing to get ready
for
that?
That's right. Well, I've been watching a bunch of Alexander and a bunch of DeRobertis on TLU.
And then after you watch these things, you learn about the people, do you sometimes contact them?
I do. I reached out to DeRobertis. I got to check my email if he responded. I don't know if he has. David.
No, because I thought that because Shamia reached out to him about her case.
Yeah.
Another employment case, and she's already got a meeting with him next week.
I think why? Because she may have CC'd you on the email, whereas I just emailed him directly.
Yeah, man. Don't you gotta throw away. He's teaching a one-day employment class out, like it's the most popular last year.
Well, his employment results are just so otherworldly. That I don't expect him to necessarily respond to my email, my measly email, but
there's a good chance he will, because he's that kind of
he's
guy.
He's a guy kind of guy.
Which makes it really helpful
when
you can reach out to these people and you already understand how their mind works.
Right.
And so that when you have a conversation with them, they know that you've done your homework and not just some dumbass calling them like fucking with your hand out and be like, I don't know shit. I haven't done shit to do the work, but I really want
But I want a template, please.
Right, right. I want you to help me, but I haven't done shit to help myself. That's always annoying.
Yeah.
That is always annoying. So Shemek, let's see. How do people get a hold of you?
They can call me at 312-375-2238. That's my cell number. They can go to winforyou.com. That's my new firm's website. Or they can email me at lubecki@winforyou.com.
Great. And if anybody needs to get a hold of me, pretty obvious. My cell phone's 248-808-3130, dan@trialawyersuniversity.com. Let's see. If you don't have TLU on demand and you want to try it out because it's an app for your phone, and we've collected all the pleadings, transcripts, and PowerPoints for all these cases, and keep them in a file cloud folder, so it's a good roadmap for trial. And it's also got a little AI component on it that works pretty good for searching the database and trying to find specific cases that can guide you on what you're trying to figure out. And I'll see you all in Huntington Beach, June 2nd. It's going to be great June 2nd. We're playing pickleball with Supio. We got a surf camp with Ed Saramboli, and we got a dinner. We're buying out the Larea restaurant. That's going to be so cool. And the pool around it. So dinner for 300. Because like 300, you saw that movie. You know what I mean? So it's like, we have dinner.
The Spartan.
300 Spartan Warriors getting together, connecting before the big game starts.
That's then, awesome.
Wednesday, we have just workshops that day. But there's going to be a golf outing, you know, hosted by Ted Wacker and Even Up. And then we got Pickleball by Supio. And we got Kurt Zander taking PL go-karting. And then we got our opening party that night.
You know what? On the Colorado case, I got to call Kurt. Because there's some pretty onerous time limits in Colorado. I don't like it for voir dire. But I'm going to talk to him to see how he's navigating. Yeah.
I know that's how it goes, though. So it's going to be cool, though. So this is going to be great because then talk about the Colorado case at TLU, and then you're doing the one out in California with Jorge and SEMA. And then that way you guys can come out to the beach house and work that up. They're very excited about that. I mentioned that SEMA.
Awesome.
She's like, I love that idea. I'm like, really? I'm surprised you would love that idea. But she loved the idea. So
I think it's a great idea. We're going to put in the work just like we did the last three days here.
It's great. Like, when you get together and you work in person on your case.
Yeah.
Just so much more energy, just so much more.
Right, and I appreciate you being a precipitator of all that. Made it happen.
I happen to be here. You know, I have to hang out with my friends and get lonely, so I got to have them all flying in time to visit me.
That's right.
Well, all right, sounds good. Great. If you're not at TLU Beach, you got to ask yourself just one question. Why the fuck not?
Right.
All right. That's what Eggenberg would say. Why the fuck not? All right.
All right, Dan, so everybody who's watching is wondering, why the hell do you have a bronze medal around your neck? Well, how about you transport us to wherever you were that you won that?
I was at the brocation at Mike Alder's ZA Ranch, and bronze was being the third most sociable person there. And, you know, I think, you know, because I think I'm Mr. Social. So I was like, and the guy he gave most social to was my buddy Abe Matthews, who did Trojan Horse, like, 7 years ago.
See, he used those connection skills to beat you.
Yeah, but the funny part was, like, we were doing a voir dire class he signed up for, but he didn't prepare at all. And he just, like, he walked right out of it. He's like, you know what? You guys just do this. I'm not going to participate. But it's the first time I've seen him since then. And he had the most, but he was, like, spent a lot of time alone. And I was like, I said, I think this is rigged. I said, this is unfair. And Mike's like, Dan, it's a, you know, he's come out of a shell a lot since he's been here. So, he made a lot of, anyways, but we had a great time out at his ranch. We were there for 3 days. There was about 20 folks from around the country, mostly lawyers. And we, you know, had great meals and great cooking outdoors. It was a little chilly, but played pickleball. We ping pong. Chet, you know, this guy was there, Zach, who had some crazy life experiences from the military and almost died and talking about that and, you know, putting life in perspective. So that wasn't just a little bit, but it was mostly just hanging out, playing ping pong. I got a lot of ping pong in. And yes, I was number one at ping pong. And
yeah, I was going to say that I would expect that Browns,
I mean, you know,
that Browns was not for pickleball.
No, it wasn't for athletic sports. There was no awards for athletics. I was upset about that. But actually, there was an award for most participant. Everybody got an award, though. So that made me feel good.
Very nice.
Once I saw everybody got one, And I was like, I had participation award. This was great. But it was, we did, there was archery. It was too cold for me though, because my hands are fragile. And that cornhole game, because it has this big ass barn. Right. So every night we just hang out.
Right.
And
yeah, Mike invited me a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah, you were out there.
Yeah, Mike's a great guy, obviously a phenomenal trial lawyer.
What a time, though.
He had some good speakers. It was in the summertime.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Some of the local guys came from around here. Mario came out there, so.
Nice.
But I will be back there next year. I'm not sure the dates, but about the same thing. It worked out great, though, because it was right before this.
Right.
And so this actually because it's brocation, because I was in Miami, then to here. I mean, then to his place. Then I had 3 days in between, so I'm like, let's get together.
Let's do some casework.
Let's get Ray in town. We get some Ray Christopher time. So made it all worth it just to see Ray. But brocation, you got to come next year.
I will.
It's like, it's really quite a lot of fun. It's a great place out there too.
Right,
like,
he's got a nice big huge ranch.
Dude, we
spread.
Could do like, yeah. I'm looking forward to doing like a 40 or 50 person like training boot camp out there. We might put that together.
Cool, yeah. And well, I'm only 50 minutes away on the other side of the lake. So
you?
Yeah,
it's convenient for you.
Very convenient. Let's make it even better.
You.
Yep.
I make it convenient for you. Okay, that's fantastic. That's a cut now. Now we see a brocation 2027. We can't wait. Thanks, Mike.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at TrialLawyersUniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to TLUOnDemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University, produced and powered by LawPods.